It's fundraising week at Iowa Public Radio, and your gift today keeps IPR strong as we continue to tell the stories from where they happen and bring you vital reporting on this global pandemic. Make your gift now and make a real difference at iowapublicradio.org. Thanks.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope you're starting off the new year in good shape. This hour, we want to listen back to some short favorite conversations I had on this program last year. Of course, the coronavirus pandemic colored nearly every part of our lives for most of 2020. Nearly 8 months ago, back in April, in the early weeks of the pandemic, I spoke with Cedar Rapids resident Larry Potter. Larry's in his mid-60s. He was the first person to be released from Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids after testing positive for the coronavirus. Some of his time there was spent in the ICU on a ventilator. Larry and I spoke just days after he left the hospital.
I was admitted on the 29th into the ICU, spent 9 days there. Two on a ventilator, and then 6 days in rehab.
Let's have you take us back to when you first detected the first symptoms. What did you first notice, and when?
Well, on March 20th, I started feeling sick. had a fever, difficulty breathing, all the basic symptoms. And, you know, one that I'm not sure that a lot of people know about, you lose the, or at least I did, I lost the sense of smell mm-hmm. and taste. It was dramatic because it wasn't just faded, it was gone. So on the 24th, we FaceTimed our personal doctor. But one thing we didn't know, the thermometer we had at home didn't work.
Oh, no.
So he said, I know. He says, my gosh, you've got all the symptoms except the fever. And I said, I know. And so we went on another day or two, and then I was shivering at night, couldn't get enough covers. I told my wife, I said, I think maybe our thermometer's broken. So she found one. Luckily, they're probably not that easy to find. She found one at Hy-Vee, and sure enough, it was 102.
Oh, my goodness.
So then my doctor sent me to Mercy Medical Center. On the 26th, they diagnosed me with pneumonia and gave me the COVID test, which thank God for that. They're very difficult to get, but they did give me one.
Mm-hmm. Take us from your arrival at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids to how you arrived on a ventilator. How did your symptoms progress?
Well, I was admitted on the 29th in the late afternoon, early evening. They did a chest x-ray first thing and sent me directly to ICU. I was there that night through the day, and then the very next evening, I guess a 24-hour period I was there. There was a flurry of activity in my room. There were doctors, anesthesiologists, nurses, med techs. There must have been seven or eight people in there. I couldn't believe it. They they told me that I needed to be placed in a medical-induced coma and put on a ventilator.
Wow.
So,
What were your thoughts at that moment?
Well, I didn't really fully understand the severity of my condition. No fault of theirs. It's just I'm not a medical professional, so I didn't really realize how serious it was. I just asked him. I said, well, is that your recommendation? He says, yes, we have to stay ahead of this. So I said, well, just do it then. Mm-hmm. And then that's when they put me on the ventilator.
Right. Okay. And then your waking happened when? Your next memory is from when?
Well, I was in that state for 2 days, and I don't remember any equipment in the room. I just remember being awake and seeing the nurse, a nurse or two, and a doctor, and and still feeling very, very sick. I was so sick that it was difficult for me to turn over, to roll on my side, or or really do much of anything. Difficulty breathing. I was receiving 6 liters of oxygen.
Looking back, Larry, on this experience, how close did you come to losing your life, do you feel?
Well, I didn't understand it until after I was in ICU for 9 days. And then when I got out into rehab, I started looking online. And 80% of the people that are placed on ventilators never come out. That was a real surprise. But I just felt fortunate, and the whole thing though was not a bad experience, because I learned so much watching the medical professionals, the staff. I saw unselfish act of kindness. I talked to them, and that's really how I tried to pass my time, is to get to know them, and it changed my life for the better to see how they react in a stressful situation. It's wow. Impressive. Yeah, the things that I learned, I came out of there a better person than I was when I went in, just by virtue of being around those people and observing how how unselfish they are. They risk their lives every day. Even the housekeeping, to come in to my room at the risk of catching that, and they do it every day.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Larry, before we go, I want a little bit more about your background, because, you know, we have in our midst in Iowa, across the nation, still many people who are not taking this seriously enough. A little bit about your background. You are not a layabout. You are a fit 65-year-old, right?
Extremely fit. Let me tell you, I don't know if I think this is, well, everyone in Iowa should know what RAGBRAI is. It's the ride across Iowa they have once a year. I've done 30 of those in a row. I've ridden as much as 150 miles in one day.
Wow.
I'm an avid cyclist, extremely fit. I thought when this first came about, well, if I catch it, I catch it. It'll be like a cold, and I'll just shake it off and move on. It is not like that. If you catch it, I mean, I was so physically fit. I lost 30 pounds in the hospital in 16 days. And you want to follow the social distancing. You've got to wear a mask, wash your hands. It's very, very serious. Mm-hmm. It has changed my whole outlook.
Larry Potter of Cedar Rapids, a survivor of COVID-19, sharing his experience with us back in April, just days after he left the hospital. We checked in with Larry to see how he's doing now. Let me read from an email he sent us last week. "My recovery was good," he writes. "It took about 4 months to regain my stamina and ability to bicycle at my previous ability. I can now ride as fast and as far as I always could, but I do have continued occasional feeling of a need to cough. I suppose I have some lung damage, but it does not inhibit my ability to ride, so I guess it's all good." Larry goes on, "I was so lucky to live through my experience with COVID that I take nothing for granted. I thank God each day and try to be a better person than I was prior to my illness." Words from Larry Potter of Cedar Rapids. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, listening back to some of the most memorable interviews heard on this program in 2020. George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police on May 25th, a shocking death caught on video, a killing that ignited a summer of protests across the country. Just days after Floyd's death, I spoke with State Representative Roz Smith of Waterloo. Smith is a member of Iowa's Legislative Black Caucus. Here's Representative Smith reflecting on the police killing of George Floyd in May, just days after it happened.
You know, it's hard. It's hard for a few reasons. I think one, during COVID-19, there's been some instances that have really spoken to, sadly, the foundation of our country, right? And I think the thing that kind of caught most of us off guard is that we thought COVID-19 was uniting all of us. We know that there are some shared gaps, right, when it comes to access to healthcare, access to quality education, but there are some shared struggles that we have as Americans. But we felt as though there was going to be a sense of unity. Our country was going to unify against this thing, right, this pandemic, to ensure that we take care of each other. But when we saw the fractures along a racial line, it was eerily reminiscent of a time when I never experienced, I've only heard of my grandparents and my parents. And I think the feeling, the atmosphere, the climate, how thick it is, it feels as though our society is on the brink, right? This is our greatest opportunity to work through this thing and actually achieve what we aspire to be, American values. Or this is our greatest odds to tumble into a time where I don't know many of us have ever seen before.
Mm-hmm. Protests all across the country from this incident, but also other similar racially related incidents we've had in the past few weeks. Many of the protests, we have to say, many peaceful protesters out there against the death of George Floyd, but several of them chaotic, especially in Minneapolis, shots fired in other cities as well. Protests planned for here in Iowa on the weekend. One group, Mothers Against Violence, announced it's going to hold a march in Des Moines. What do you say, especially, or what is your feeling about the protests that are not peaceful? What do you say to people who say, we understand, we've seen that video of George Floyd, but why does this have to end in violent protest, the burning of a police precinct?
So, I don't condone violence. I don't condone the protests and the looting. I think that's something that is lost, is misinterpreted energy. But I think we have to pay attention to what's being communicated by the people, right? I think James Baldwin and King have both spoken loudly about this because they were experiencing this in their time as well. These are communities that have been looted. These are communities that have been robbed of resources. These are people that have been underserved and taken advantage of since 1619. So I guess James Baldwin would ask, who's looting who? But King would also say, if this is the way people are communicating, if we're seeing this sort of desperation in people that they're willing to go to this length, doesn't it behoove us to perk our ears up and be aware of the cries of the impoverished? Be aware of what's happening to those that are the least of us. And not that we have to acknowledge that what they're doing is right and just. That is not a righteous cause, in my opinion. But if we pay attention to what's actually happened and have ears to hear each other, if we can understand that people are expressing their anger in a way that they don't know how to do anything else, I can tell you when I watched the video of the George Floyd being killed, my heart went out to not only him but the individual filming the video, because for me, I would have lost my life that day to sit there and watch and feel so helpless that law enforcement can take the life of somebody that looks like you in front of you, and your option is stand here and record it or get involved and lose my life. That's desperation. And my heart is broken because in that circumstance, I would have lost my life. And I don't know what that means. I don't know how to portray that, how that's perceived by white America. But I tell you, when you see people looting, what else can we do? This has been when he says, I can't breathe, this is 400 years of I can't breathe, of oppression on my chest. And something has to change.
This morning, as the Minneapolis Police Department 3rd Precinct building burned, President Trump lashed out on Twitter, called the city's mayor very weak, said the thugs are dishonoring memory of George Floyd. He also suggested that protesters could be shot. Any difficulty, quoting his tweet, any difficulty and we will assume control, but when the looting starts, the shooting starts. What's your reaction to the president's tweet and his leadership on this?
I would treat the president with respect not because he's a gentleman, but because I was raised one. So I will say this. I expect better from leadership. I think to condone that is really what stokes the underbelly of what's happening in our communities. I live in Waterloo, which is historically one of the most segregated cities in the state of Iowa, which just rated one of the worst cities to live in as African Americans. That does not help our goal in uniting our community and ensuring a high quality of life and equity for everybody, black, white, and everything in between. So I think for me, it's disappointing that that's what our leadership is doing. But I can tell you this, I'm working diligently every day to ensure that there are different results than somebody sitting in that chair in the White House come November, because that's not what our nation is about.
Let's talk about leadership at a state level in the Iowa legislature. You are part of that legislature. What do you think we need to hear from leadership here in Iowa at this moment in the legislature, from the governor's office? What do you think this will spark, perhaps, from the legislature?
I guess my hope is to spark something. As of right now, the plan doesn't seem to be to take care of Iowa workers. The plan doesn't seem to ensure that there's quality access to education and health care for all Iowans. I don't believe that our legislature has an appetite right now to address some of the issues we've seen so that George Floyd can happen here. We know that, you know, we've proposed legislation, whether it be expanding minority impact statements or racial profiling legislation, or ensuring that our county attorneys aren't put in difficult situations when they have to bring charges against a police officer that they may work hand in hand with. But I think one thing that our state needs to prioritize is ensuring that we establish a House and Senate Criminal Justice Reform Committee. I think that committee has the ability to get input from the public on how we improve our community. But I think what people should be aware of and start calling out before it happens are the calls for cuts to our budget. We know that there are billions of federal dollars flowing into our state, and it behooves Iowa Republicans to utilize this money to ensure that we don't place any further burden on hardworking Iowans who are already struggling due to COVID-19. I think to not accept federal funds will be negligent, and I'm fearful what that looks like for education, healthcare, and workers in our state.
My conversation with State Representative Ross Smith of Waterloo in May of 2020, recorded just days after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. In June, following protests calling for police reform in Des Moines and across the state, the Iowa State Legislature passed a statewide bill aimed at certain aspects of police reform. Representative Smith was involved in crafting that legislation. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, listening back to some of the most memorable interviews heard on this program in 2020. Alfonso Medina owns La Carreta, a Mexican restaurant in Marshalltown. When he put a social justice-themed sign up at his business, he thought he was just expressing views that everyone could stand behind. It turned out not everyone could. A social media post from Medina went viral. Some took issue with his messages, and it sparked a new viral catchphrase, "No love, no tacos." I spoke with Alfonso Medina of Marshalltown in October of 2020.
It all started because of a small, basic human rights kind of yard sign that you see kind of popping out everywhere. And it just read, a few lines like, "No human is illegal, Black Lives Matter, water is life, science is real, women's rights are human rights." And that was the simple sign that I decided to put out on my business. I keep my business neutral from political parties and anything. And I just decided it was a common sense, basic human rights sign, Well, you got some letters, and one was the one that I decided to post online, which didn't have an author, didn't have anybody to reply to, so it was anonymous. Very, very upset and calling it very unchristian of us. And it was a pretty long post, which is, I was very surprised that people actually read my long post. But sometimes when I encounter a very long post online, I don't have time to read it. But at the end of my post, I ended it with, "No love, no tacos," kind of a comical way to say, if there's no love in you, then maybe you shouldn't eat tacos, because tacos are full of love, and it just blew up from there.
Alfonso, back to that original objection from the anonymous letter from a patron of your store. What was he or she objecting to?
Well, they were talking about all the talking points and mostly about love is love and about women's rights. Maybe probably with a whole dilemma of pro-life or pro-choice. They were just, pretty upset. But I still don't know to this day who it was, but it jump-started a very big movement. And I'm, as a business-minded person that I am, I trademarked the phrase, and I made some apparel, and I was able to donate quite a bit of money for a scholarship fund that I already had in place for about 5 years here at the Marshalltown Community College to, you know, to have people, you know, further their education. And I founded it when I was 25 years old. And it just exploded, you know, not just statewide, countrywide, but abroad as well.
Mm-hmm. So this sign-off you had in response to that objection to the sign supporting Black Lives Matter and women's rights as human rights, it was just a sign-off occurred to you spontaneously, no love, no tacos. Give us an idea of how widespread this story has become. Who have you been talking to? What media has it been in?
Yeah, so kind of what might have a little bit explored more too, because it's like kind of doubled down. I put a big billboard outside my property. There was one of those billboard companies that became actually available once I became available. And I said, you know what, I'm gonna put no love, no tacos on there for a few months. And that kind of got some attention nationwide. What kind of made it explode was, you know, national coverage from CNN.
After all of this, the weeks, the months that the No Love, No Tacos has been around, T-shirt sales, you mentioned contributing thousands of dollars to a scholarship fund that are raised by the T-shirt sales with No Love, No Tacos. Mm-hmm. Well, what is your conclusion about what No Love, No Tacos means?
Well, I think food is an opener and for a lot of people that, you know, don't know a lot of about different cultures and about different ways of thinking. And Mexican food, at least here in the U.S., you know, it has been a growing trend since, you know, the 90s. And you'll see a Mexican restaurant in towns where there's not a lot of diversity. And, you know, it's the opening to a culture and to try something new and to show respect and for the values of other people. And what No Love, No Tacos right now has turned into, I made it to a website, which is actually in the process of becoming a nonprofit. But if you go to nolovenotacos.org, what you'll find there is our first mission is to help and aid in making this election the most just as possible as we can make it, and are calling to make Election Day a national holiday or a federal holiday where, you know, everything closes down and everybody who can vote has the ability to go vote.
Okay,
So that's what I kind of turned down to right now. Yep.
Okay, we'll watch this story. Alfonso Medina, owner of La Carreta in Marshalltown and the trademark owner of No Love, No Tacos. Alfonso, thanks.
Yep, thank you so much. Have a great day. Appreciate it.
Coming up after a short break, we'll be back with more conversations from last year. We'll remember the high-profile Michelle Martinko murder trial, the restoration of automatic voting rights for Iowans with felony convictions, and my conversation with internationally acclaimed opera singer and Iowa native Simon Estes. Our retrospective featuring some favorite conversations from 2020 continues after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're remembering some of the top news stories from 2020 by listening back to a few conversations from this program. We begin this half hour with the widely publicized murder trial of Michelle Martinko from late February of last year. IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter Kate Payne covered the trial.
After listening to almost 2 weeks of testimony, a jury of seven women and five men returned a verdict in a murder case that has haunted the community of Cedar Rapids for 40 years.
The verdict appears to be in order. The members of the jury, through the foreman, have signed verdict form number one. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jerry Lynn Burns, guilty of the charge of murder in the first degree, dated this 24th day of February 2020, signed by the foreman of the jury, Mr. Lynch.
The voice of Judge Faye Hoover on Monday Jerry Lynn Burns, guilty of first-degree murder in the stabbing death of 18-year-old Michelle Martinko in Cedar Rapids in 1979. Kate Payne, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter, has covered this trial from the very beginning, held at the Scott County Courthouse in Davenport. A judge moved it out of Lynn County due to pretrial publicity. Kate, this trial is over. A verdict has been returned very quickly. Just shy of 3 hours it took this jury to return the verdict. What was it like in the courtroom at that moment?
It was somewhat surprising that the jury came back into the courtroom, made their decision so quickly. It was very surprising for those of us in the room because there was so much evidence for them to sift through. What a monumental case, but definitely an emotional moment for the family of Michelle Martinko. Her sister and her sister's husband had been there in the courtroom the entire trial. Other members of their family, students who went to school with Michelle Martinko 40 years ago. So a really emotional moment for them.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask you to outline the prosecution's key evidence and the defense in this case, remind us, for those of us who might not know, how did this trial come about after 40 years?
Yeah, so at the time, it was hugely shocking for Cedar Rapids. There was no murder weapon, no clear motive in this case. So for decades, it sort of languished. There were always people working it at some level, but it really wasn't until DNA analysis caught up in the past, you know, few years that investigators were able to go back, take another look at this case, and have DNA evidence that came from the crime scene decades ago, have that reanalyzed, and using a family genealogy website that's typically used by hobbyists, they were able to upload the profile that they found at the crime scene of an unknown man, and they got a hit from it, a distant cousin. And based on that information, a private firm was able to build out a family tree, and law enforcement were able to follow those people around, covertly take samples of their DNA from trash that they had left behind, and ultimately narrow their search down to three brothers and find Jerry Burns. They followed him to a pizza ranch, picked up a straw that he left behind, tested it, and said it was consistent.
2 weeks of this trial, 2 weeks of testimony. What was the key evidence, looking back, in your estimation, that the prosecution had for this conviction that convinced the jury very quickly, evidently, that he is the murderer?
So it really comes down to that initial genetic profile that was found on the dress that Michelle Martinko was wearing when she was killed, and also more blood that was found in the car where she was stabbed. So investigators were able to point to, in two different places at the crime scene, that there was this male genetic profile, that they were consistent to each other. The spot on the dress was found in a blood stain, and jurors found that that was convincing when they were shown evidence that those two blood stains, profiles taken from them, were consistent with each other, and that that male profile was consistent with Jerry Burns. That was convincing for them.
Mm-hmm. And how did the defense answer that convincing evidence, it seems?
So they never really contested that the profile was not Burns's. They were really trying to raise other questions about, you know, it's been 40 years, that's a long time, you know, was this evidence ever mishandled? Could there have been a potential for contamination? They also raised the idea that, you know, as we travel around in the world, we're all leaving our DNA all over the place. You know, is it possible that Michelle Martinko encountered his DNA at some other point in time before she was murdered, sort of by accident, picking up his skin cells, say? But that was not convincing for the jury.
And the prosecution answered that with, this is way too far-fetched.
Way too far-fetched. And the idea, again, that the profile consistent with Burns was found in two different places in the crime scene. So it's like the idea of, well, maybe if it wound up on her dress, then how was his DNA then transferred to this blood stain on the gear shifter in the car? You know, how could that have happened?
Jerry Lynn Burns did indeed kill Michelle Martinko in 1979, according to this verdict. Do we know anything more about the motive after all of this testimony?
So before the trial itself, prosecutors had been able to search Byrne's computer history during 2018, and they found his taste in porn was very violent, searching things like strangulation, blonde women, those ideas, into stabbing, really, really violent searches. That information was not allowed to be entered as evidence into the trial itself.
The jury did not hear
any. The jury did not hear that. The judge decided, you know, it's been 40 years at that point between the crime took place and he made those searches, and the judge decided that that would prejudice the jury and that he should not be put in prison for life based on his taste in pornography. Mm-hmm. So the jury never saw that, but for those who do have that knowledge, it can give a glimpse into some of his thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Kate Payne, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter. She covered the trial held at the Scott County Courthouse. Jury of seven women, five men returning a guilty verdict. Jerry Lynn Byrne's guilty of first-degree murder in the stabbing death of Michelle Martinko in 1979. Kate Payne, thank you.
Thanks.
My conversation from late February of 2020 with IPR's Kate Payne following the conviction of Jerry Byrne's for the murder of Michelle Martinko. Next, my conversation from March 2020 with internationally acclaimed opera singer and Iowa native Simon Estes. Early in 2020, Iowa State University's Music Hall was renamed Simon Estes Music Hall to honor his musical legacy.
What an honor. Welcome to you, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted and honored to speak with you.
Tell us, what does this mean to you to have the Music Hall at ISU bear your name now?
Well, needless to say, I'm deeply humbled and I'm honored. It's very moving, it's touching, it's emotional, and I just feel very, very, very blessed that they decided to name it the Simon Estes Music Hall. It was a big surprise, I must honestly say. They had mentioned it to me some time ago, a few months ago, and it became a reality. So I'm very thankful.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it will be motivating to all of my colleagues, not only at Iowa State University, but other universities and colleges here in Iowa, to let all of them know that you can come from a little town in Iowa of humble upbringing with no economic power, because my father and my mother, we were very poor economically speaking, but I just want young people to know that you can always achieve, as long as you are determined and disciplined and dedicated, you can achieve whatever you want to do in life.
I wonder if you could share more about your upbringing. Born in Centerville, Iowa, your father was a coal miner, your grandfather a former slave?
Yes, he was a slave, sold for $500. He was born in Kentucky in 1837. And my father was born in 1891, and he couldn't read or write, but he had a great heart, and he was a great father and a great husband. He was also in the First World War, so he served our country. But Centerville was just a very small town. And, of course, there was discrimination there, as there was in Iowa City or Davenport or Council Bluffs, wherever. But my parents always taught my three older sisters and me never to hate, to be strong, and to pray for those people who maybe didn't treat us so nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great upbringing. I loved school. I was motivated by my teachers in Centerville. And E.W. Fannin, who was the superintendent of all of the schools in Centerville, my junior year in high school, invited me to come over to his house and have a piece of cake and lemonade with him and his wife. And I've never forgotten what he said to me. He said, "Simon, if you continue to keep your nose to the grindstone, you're going to be somebody someday." And I said, "Well, thank you, Mr. Fannin." I had no idea, of course, what he was talking about, and I had no idea I was going to be an opera singer.
Uh-huh. When was the first time you remember being told that you had a magnificent, expressive voice in the world-class voice for opera?
It happened at the University of Iowa in 1961. I changed my major a number of times at the University of Iowa, but anyhow, a teacher came there in 1961 named Charles Kellis, and he heard me singing, and he said he was going through the corridor at North Hall in Iowa City, and he said he heard my voice penetrating through a closed door. And so I started singing also with the old gold singers, and he said, you know, you have a voice to sing opera. And I said, having come from Centerville, what is opera? And they played some recordings of some great opera singers, a bass named Cesare Siepi from Italy, and Leontine Price and Maria Callas. And he played one symphony music piece for me, Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. And after I finished listening to those big 33 and a thirds, I said to Mr. Kellis, I really like that stuff. I call it stuff. So he is the man who introduced me to opera and discovered me, because otherwise I don't think I would be talking to you today, because I didn't know anything about an opera, nor had I heard one before.
I want to mention some of your other wonderful work. You are in the middle of your Roots and Wings tour that you launched in 2010 to perform in all 99 counties. You contribute half of your concert fee to scholarships for high school seniors. And to date, according to my information, Simon, you have more than $220,000 in scholarships donated to students in 54 counties here in Iowa. And following each concert, you give visit a local school in that county. What is the message you bring to the students you visit on this tour?
Well, after the concert, we have a little reception. Then the following day, they have a general assembly of all of the high school students. And if it's at more than one high school, then they come also. And I talk to them about values and principles and morality and character and faith and forgiveness, all of these qualities that we have to use at some point or some time in our lives. And I tell them there will be obstacles, there will be hurdles that you have to cross and you have to jump in life. But I always tell young people, never give up. And what has helped me to endure a lot of discrimination and injustice has been my faith. I grew up in a little church. It was an all-colored church, a Second Baptist Church in Centerville, Iowa. Incidentally, it is now a museum. There are not many people there at all of color, and they turn it into a museum. It's a landmark, and they've got a lot of our memorabilia there. So I grew up with education, faith, and hard work. That's what has brought me to where I am today.
All the folks work on the Mississippi.
That was my conversation from March of 2020 with internationally acclaimed opera singer and Iowa native Simon Estes. This hour, we're remembering some of the top news stories and conversations from 2020. You might remember this from last August. Governor Kim Reynolds signed an executive order restoring voting rights to Iowans with felony records, with some exclusions. Iowa was the last state in the country to bar all felons from voting unless they applied for and were granted a special exception from the governor's office. The executive order automatically restored voting rights to 60,000 Iowans, including 1 in 10 black adults in our state. We spoke with Iowa City's Eric Harris about this executive order. Eric Harris, welcome back to the program.
Yes, thank you.
Let me ask you about this week. What was your reaction to the announcement this week by the governor that she will have this executive order?
It was very great. It was a great feeling. It was something that I worked like really hard to accomplish. I tried my best to send letters, do like interviews. So it was kind of it's a temporary thing because it's just a executive order, but it's still a huge victory.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch it on TV or on the internet?
I watched it as it happened. Yeah, it was like watching, it's like people like gathered around to watch like a Super Bowl or something like that. You know, I gathered around and had some of my family around and we watched it, and it was just a huge victory.
Well, when you say you've done work here, I want to point out in more detail what you've done. In fact, you wrote a letter to Governor Reynolds a few days ago about restoring felon voting rights. It was sent via mail, published in the Des Moines Register at the end of last month, I believe.
And perhaps you can comment. This is from your letter. Part of it, I have two nonviolent felony convictions that are several years old. My life is different and better now. I got a degree from community college in computer repair. I have a job that I'm grateful for at a restaurant, one of the few places that will hire me since I have a felony conviction. I'm so blessed that the owner believes in fair opportunities. This gives us a real sense that you're trying to communicate, hey, here, I'm trying to reintegrate, right? Or I have.
Yes, definitely. I've already did my time for my crime that I did. I don't want to have to pay two times for a crime that I did. So, I've done my time. And I just want an opportunity to be treated as a normal citizen, not a second-class citizen.
Right. And to your family here, you write in your letter to the governor, I was able to buy my first house ever, which is so important for my kids. I'm a news junkie. Outside of football, live news is all I watch. I want to be able to vote for my kids' school board and the county attorney and the city council. Somebody like me who has been through the criminal legal system has seen some things like how broken the whole system is. I want to vote for people who will change that. This is one of your big issues now that you're a voter, not only an advocate, an activist, but also a voter, right? Change the system. Tell us, what is the change you want to make?
I just want it to be a fair system, especially people with like nonviolent crimes. They just probably need to be helped out. They don't need to have felony convictions. It stops them from being able to like take advantage of a lot of opportunities, like jobs. And sometimes they have problems getting apartments. So, and like some of the rules that they have, like if you're on supervision, they are like antique rules, you know. Like for example, you can't hang around other people who have felonies, you know. So what if it's your brother or a close family member? So you can't hang out with them, you know. It just doesn't make sense.
Let me go back to your letter and quote from your letter. As a black man, I want you to know how felony disenfranchisement is a big problem for my community. It just makes people want to give up. Many of us don't have a voice in politics and can't speak up. We don't even take our problems to our lawmakers because we aren't even able to vote, so they aren't going to listen to us. So this means, do you think lawmakers will listen more to people with felony records and also black Iowans?
Yeah, I would hope so, but I think that in the beginning, it shouldn't have mattered anyway. Even if you had a felony and you did your time, you should have been able to actually vote. 60,000 is a nice number, but the thing that I want to put out there is that now we need to spread awareness, because some people, they don't even think or know that they can vote now. Or they didn't pay attention, they didn't see the news, they don't know. So now it's just awareness, because that 60,000 could actually be, you know, only about 20,000 voting, because everybody doesn't know, they don't know how to go about registering, mm-hmm. they don't know how to go about any of that, so.
Right, and the fact that so many people in our state, in our country, believe that voting doesn't matter. Were you at any time in your life a person who said, meh, my vote doesn't matter?
Yes, I definitely was a person like that. I just thought that, especially when I couldn't vote, and I was like, oh, you know, there was some point that when I couldn't vote, I figured out that I couldn't vote. I didn't make a big deal about it, because I was like, well, I guess my vote doesn't matter anyway. And so it's a lot of people that think that voting is, you know, is rigged up and it doesn't matter and it's already set up that somebody's going to win, but every voice counts.
Mm-hmm. And was there a point when that changed your mind to becoming an advocate, an activist for getting people out to vote? What changed your mind?
It would definitely be 2016. That election, that's what opened my eyes to everything. And 2016 was, you know, in my personal opinion, was almost a tragedy. So,
Well, nice to talk with you again. Eric Harris lives in Iowa City, an Iowan with a felony record, and like tens of thousands of Iowans now, because of an executive order by Kim Reynolds, our governor, will be able to vote in this next election. Eric Harris, congratulations to you on having restored voting rights, and thank you for this talk.
No problem.
That was my conversation with Eric Harris from August of 2020. We were speaking about the governor signing an executive order at the time, an order that automatically restored voting rights to tens of thousands of Iowans with certain felony convictions. This hour, we've been featuring River to River conversations related to top news stories from last year. Today's show was produced by Caitlin Harrop and Rick Brewer. Our team also includes Matt Alvarez and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, I'll ask Iowa healthcare workers from a variety of types of care to reflect on their work in 2020, of course, with a particular focus on the pandemic. We'll also ask them to share their hopes and concerns for this year, 2021. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.